20th century existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre commented, quote, "Every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance," close quote. And it's not too surprising how many of our contemporaries would agree. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Last spring semester, Dr. Scott Olson, Associate Professor of Mathematics and Natural Sciences, enjoyed a sabbatical, and, as is the rule for professors who have sabbaticals at Wyoming Catholic College, he was asked to deliver a lecture presenting his sabbatical research and ruminations to the entire school. Thus, in November, our monthly all-school lecture featured Dr. Olson speaking on, well, on the nature of everything, with the title, "What is the World For?" It's our pleasure to share with you his thought-provoking tonic for our troubled era.
What is the natural world for? What is the universe for? What is everything for? This is a big question. This is a fundamental question. And so it is not easily answered. What is the natural world for? Imagine explorers from another world came upon a never-before-seen machine and were asked to explain what it was for. It is a strangely shaped box. The box has several doors of varying sizes. Of course, they open them up and they look inside. One door leads into a small room with what must be seats, and these seats all awkwardly face in the same direction. Speakers line the walls of the room. The speakers can be controlled by a set of knobs and switches ahead of the first row of seats. Another series of switches control the humidity and ambient air temperature. It seems clear enough that our machine is for comfortably listening to musical recordings, or perhaps news or sports radio. Through a second door, they find a complex assemblage of gears and cables. The purpose of these is less obvious, although some of them appear to provide power for the stereo equipment in the larger room. Indeed, after a lengthy examination, our visitors discover that in this chamber, there is a small metal box, and this small metal box can be filled with explosive gas. The explosions are ingeniously orchestrated so that through a series of interconnected gears and rods, a magnet in another box is made to rotate within a stationary conducting armature. When this magnet turns, a current is induced in the armature, which may be fed to the stereo equipment, so that the stereo may be made to play almost indefinitely, or at least until you run out of fuel. And if the air is uncomfortably cold, heat produced by the explosion box may be diverted through short pipes into the adjacent listening chamber. Has this machine been designed so that its occupants might enjoy the ultimate music listening experience? This would explain why all the seats must face in the same direction. If an occupant were free to turn around, they would sometimes have the stereo sound inverted from left to right. It would be like putting on your headphones backwards. That doesn't sound good. It might also explain the thick belts of fabric which can secure an occupant to his chair. Maybe these remind the listener not to rudely leave his seat during a performance. I noticed with sadness that we don't have those in here. But... No, our visitors are looking at a car. Now, can they know what the car is for? Perhaps we will say, yes, it is obvious what a car is for. For just a moment, let us reflect on what gives us this confidence. Our investigators are free to look both inside and outside of the car. Clearly, whatever is within the car is related to its purpose. After all, we know that cars are for getting places, and if cars are for getting places, we will need something like engines and wheels to make this happen. Secondarily, we would like to be comfortable in the car and even to be entertained. If we weren't at least moderately comfortable, we might choose not to use the car. comfort and entertainment are at an intermediate level what the car is for. But these aren't the final end of the car. No one buys a car primarily so that they can comfortably listen to music. To really answer our question in the most final sense, what is it that the car is finally for? We will have to look outside of the car. The car did not make itself, and it does not exist for itself. You cannot understand what the car is for unless you see, of course, that there are things which are not part of the car. There are destinations, there are roads connecting them, passengers, events which we would like to attend. The point is simply that the car is not its own end, and so the purpose of the car will be outside of it. By looking inside the car, we can understand how it accomplishes what it is for, but not what it is finally for. The internal workings of the car depend on the final purpose of the car, but notice the reverse is not true. We say that the car has an engine because we want to go places, but we don't say that we want to go places because we have an engine. That is, the primary explanation we have for the car must be outside of it. But we originally asked about the natural world, not a car. What is the natural world for? Now we have a problem. Shouldn't we look for the answer outside of the thing made? Outside of the natural world? But how could we possibly do that? How could we possibly look outside of the world to see what it is for? We are in the world. We seem to be stuck in it. Indeed, every word we use and every idea we have has come to us through our experience within this world. It's as if we were investigating the car, but we could never look outside of it. In fact, the problem is worse than our car analogy suggests. The car's investigators came into the car, but we really are a part of the world. As soon as we exist, we are already in it. The analogy might have been closer to our situation if we had asked the seatbelt buckle to explain what the car was for. So what are we to do? Let us draw a few more lessons from our car. By looking inside our world, we should expect to see many things that help us understand how the world achieves its purpose, but not what its final purpose is. Human nature, the fundamental laws of physics, and everything in between will be ordered towards the most final purpose of the universe. Gravity somehow helps the universe do what it's supposed to do, although gravity can't be the point of the universe. Gravity is something like the engine in the car. The sexual appetite also somehow helps the universe do what it's supposed to do, although sex can't be the point of the universe either. It's true that the car should be comfortable, but that is only really so that we can go places, which is the more final cause of the car. Inside our world, we should likewise expect to find many purposes for what we observe, although these won't be the final purpose, which we should expect to not be observable. If the final purpose were observable, it would just be another part of our world. St. Thomas says that by natural reason, we can know that God exists. I'll take that for granted. I don't think that'll be too difficult for this audience anyway. It follows that we can know by natural reason that creation must finally be for God, because God is the only being outside of creation whom it could be for. God is the one being standing outside of the car. Unfortunately, this seems like a rather incomplete answer. In the present life, we cannot expect to entirely understand the reason for the universe, because to entirely understand the reason for the universe would be to entirely understand God. Needless to say, entirely understanding God is outside of the scope of this lecture. As Dr. Bullen might say, that is a story for another day. Students, I'm pretty sure you'll cover that the second semester, senior year. My hope for these comments is slightly more modest. In response to our question, what is the universe for? We can propose answers at different levels. We may ask, what is the world for at a level near to us creatures? If we make a beginning on this nearer question, we will not at all completely answer the fuller question, but it may be an answer we can understand. It may be an answer which is accessible to us, and it will be a real answer. What is the universe for? It is for knowing. It is for knowing God, finally, but this must happen through knowing creatures first. How is this possible? Why should this be? Whenever something is for something else, there may be a series of ends which are all an answer to the question, what is it for? For example, if I see you pouring a cup of coffee and ask, what is the pouring for? You might say, I pour the coffee so that the coffee might be in the cup, so that I might drink the coffee, so that I might stay awake, so that I might study my mathematics. So that I might learn, so that I might fall in love with reality, and so on. Gentlemen, if you take a young lady out to coffee, you might have in mind her falling in love with you. Perhaps that is what the coffee is for. Now, the barista might not be able to see your final intentions, although he would be right to think that more immediately the coffee was for drinking. Or he might see that the coffee was for a lively conversation. He wouldn't at all be wrong about these near ends, even if he couldn't see the whole and the most final end of the coffee as clearly as the two potential lovers. He needn't be aware of that to pour his coffee well. We likewise have an important job to do within the cosmos, and we can do it well, even if we cannot understand how our playing our part causes the universe to obtain its most final end, or if we cannot understand what that end fully entails just now. Finally, the universe must be for God, but the natural world is also for something more proximate to us that we can therefore better understand, much like the barista can understand that the coffee is for conversation, even if he does not see that it is finally for love. We can know what the universe is for at this intermediate level. It would be better still if we could have a more final understanding of the universe, but as in all human knowing, we must begin with what is more accessible to us and not what is most knowable in itself. We must begin our reasoning from within the world, and this is easier for us. It is easier to know rocks because we can sense them than to know God, although the rocks are not the most knowable in themselves. Rest assured, there is more to know about God than rocks. Everything is knowable insofar as it is an act. Conversely, when things have potential, which God does not, they are to that extent less knowable because they could be otherwise. What does that mean? The same stuff that makes me able to sit and stand, what we can call my matter, also makes me able to die. And right now, you can't know whether tomorrow I will sit or stand, or even be alive, precisely because I am made of this stuff. In one way, my matter makes me knowable to you, because we are all capable of sensing matter. You can see and hear me. But my matter also makes me unknowable. I can be one way now and another way later. Imagine you were trying to prove something about a geometrical figure, but the figure changed as you looked at it. One moment it had three sides, and the next it had four. You couldn't say, for example, that the sum of its angles was 180 degrees. The more something is able to change, the less we can say about it with necessity. God, because he isn't made of this stuff, is the least changeable and therefore the most knowable, but also the least accessible to our human way of knowing. Take a moment and appreciate the oddity of this situation. If you were God, and you were making a universe, if you wanted your creatures to know about you, would you have made their knowing depend first on what was least like you? The universe we see around us is such that in order to think about God, we first have to think about the things which are least like God. In order to think about God who is purely immaterial, we have to first look at what is thoroughly material. What's going on here? Isn't that backwards? Is it possible that God simply made a colossal mistake? Was this an oversight? A momentary lapse in judgment? A managerial slip of the existential pen? Or is it possible that this wasn't God's great blunder? Might there be a reason why God wants us to look at the rocks? For now, let us return to our question. What is this all for? It must be finally that the universe is for God's own sake, but before that, from our limited creaturely perspective, the purpose of the universe is for us to love God. But even before that, the universe must be for us to know God. This is because it is impossible to love something if we do not know it. Echoing Augustine, St. Thomas will say, "Nihil diligitur nisi cognitum." Nothing can be loved unless it has first been known. As someone who loves and teaches mathematics, I think about this a lot. Nothing can be loved unless it is first known. People don't love mathematics, first of all, because they don't know it. The world is full of people that think that mathematics is when you cry at the kitchen table over Saxon algebra. That is not mathematics. The mathematics is the knowing part, which everyone loves. It's as if someone stopped their exercise routine because, as they said, they didn't like being healthy. Don't they really mean that they disliked the painful work or perhaps the struggle to find the time? When we first learn a mathematical idea, we all feel ignorant. Unfortunately, it is easy to confuse our hatred of this ignorance with the knowing itself. The knowing is delightful. This seems to present an insurmountable difficulty for learners. We can't love things we don't know, but it seems like we won't labor to know if we don't love. How are we to get started with the knowing so that we can get on to the loving? The answer is that we all come into this world, pre-programmed, as it were, with the desire to know. Aristotle tells us that every man by his nature desires to know. If we want to find the desire to know, we won't have to go looking outside of ourselves. It's already in us. This is obvious if we reflect on our own experiences. We like knowing things. Why should this be? I can see animals having a desire for food or having a desire for sexual reproduction, but why should we all desire to know that the sum of the angles in a triangle is 180 degrees? Why would this inclination be an essential feature of every person? It would be a very curious thing if this were merely a coincidence. But it is not a coincidence. We desire knowing because we were made for union with God, who's most of all knowable and who is purely intelligible. When we know the good, we desire it. That is, when we know, we love. Thomas says, "The good apprehended is necessarily loved." It is impossible to know the good without being inclined to it. You see, knowing is for lovers. It's my new bumper sticker. It's not just Virginia. And not only can we say that knowing is for lovers, by the very fact of knowing the good, knowers are necessarily lovers. Let us put a few of these observations together. We all desire to know. We must desire to know most of all what is the most knowable, which we said was God. When we know, we must first know the least things, which are least knowable in themselves, but most accessible to us. We really want to know God, but we have to know the rocks to get there. Everything in the universe stands as an effect of God. Everything we can know can be known only through our sensation of these effects. If we could not know God through these things, we could not know God. This means that by our nature, we've been placed on a kind of intellectual trajectory. In order to know what is best and what we desire most, we'll have to be knowers of many things. We have to start with rocks, but we won't be satisfied to end there. So how is it that knowing about the world might give us a knowledge of God? Or to put that another way, how can we know the cause from his effects? First, let us consider how the cause, God, and his effects, the natural world, are related. It sometimes happens that an effect is equal to a cause. For example, you might have a mathematical statement which is equivalent to another mathematical statement. If we assume one, it will imply the other and vice versa. We say such statements are convertible. We know that in Euclidean geometry, if a triangle has two equal angles, it'll have two equal sides. We call this an isosceles triangle. Conversely, if a triangle has two equal sides, it'll have two equal angles. Two equal angles. In a triangle, having two equal angles and having two equal sides have the same logical implications. They are virtually, that is, in their power, the same. Generally, mathematical statements are not convertible. Given that we have an isosceles triangle, it follows that the sum of its angles is 180 degrees, but the converse is not true. If the sum of a triangle's angles is 180 degrees, it may or may not be an isosceles triangle. The relationship between God and the natural world is not convertible. The cause exceeds the effect. If we knew God perfectly, we could know the world perfectly. But we won't understand God perfectly by understanding his creation, even if we were able to perfectly understand it. The words which we have, which are always attached to created and sensible things, will always fall short of their cause, God. Speaking to this, St. Thomas says in the Summa, For these names express God so far as our intellect knows him. Now, since our intellect knows God from creatures, it knows him as far as creatures represent him. God prepossesses in himself all the perfections of creatures, being himself simply and universally perfect. Hence, every creature represents him and is like him so far as it possesses some perfection. Yet it represents him not as something of the same species or genus, but as the excelling principle of whose form the effect falls short, although they derive some kind of likeness thereto. So when we say God is good, the meaning is not God is the cause of goodness, or God is not evil, but the meaning is whatever good we attribute to creatures pre-exists in God and in a more excellent and higher way. End quote. Let us go back to our car. Suppose now we are inside of the car and cannot be outside of it. The cause of the car outside of the car is greater than the car. The cause is greater than its effects. What can we learn now from inside the car about its causes? We've already seen that the cause and effect do not have the relation of equality. They are not equal in power, one implying the other. The car and the car's engineer are not convertible. I tried to make a joke out of that. There's got to be one there, if anyone's got one. That is, from within the car, we will not be able to comprehend everything about the cause of the car. How is it that the cause and the effect are related? If the effect is less than the cause, what can we understand about the relation? Following St. Thomas in his commentary on Boethius' De Trinitate, we can proceed in three ways. First, the fact that the cause and effect are not equal makes it clear that the cause is prior to the effect and not vice versa. We can say about the car's designer that he is a cause and not an effect of the car. This means we can see that the designer has a certain power to produce things, namely cars. Whereas we do not infer that engines and seatbelts have a certain power to produce automotive engineers. That is, we consider the relation between cause and effect. The first thing we see is that the cause is prior to the effect. We understand it really as a cause. Secondly, although the car is not equal to its causes, it must somehow resemble them. If a car has anything, it must have it from its causes. The causes must have had it first. A cause couldn't have given what it didn't have to give. For example, if we drop a car, it'll fall. Why does it fall? It has this property only because whatever the car is made out of had the falling property. The car's matter is one of its causes. Likewise, the car is structured in a certain way. It is organized. This is only possible because that structure was in the mind of whoever made the car, who is also a cause of the car. As we grow in our understanding of the car, we must grow in corresponding admiration of its designer. Surely everything great in the car reflects something great in its creator. Since the car is like its cause, we can learn more about the cause as we grow in appreciation of its effects. But lastly, the car also falls short of its causes. Whoever designed this car may have designed many other cars and thought many other things. Not all of these effects, not all of these aspects are present in this particular car. He, after all, was a complete person. He wasn't just a car designer. Perhaps he was born in New York to impoverished immigrants, became a soldier, traveled the world, met his love in Paris during the war. She would give him 6 kids and a wonderful life in Southern Illinois. He wrote doggerel poetry, and he sometimes knew how to drink too much whiskey. He cried during Disney movies, but he told his kids that something just bothered his eyes. And so on. Now, look at that car again. Is that car anything like the man? There seems to be an almost... right? There seems to be an almost infinite gap between this car and the man who made it. St. Thomas says, "So the human mind advances in 3 ways in knowing God. First, by knowing more perfectly his power in producing things. Second, by knowing him as the cause of more lofty effects, which, because they bear some resemblance to him, give more praise to his greatness. Third, by an ever-growing knowledge of him as distant from everything that appears in his effects." Thus, Dionysius says that we know God as the cause of all things by transcendence and by negation. We can consider the effect as coming forth from the cause. We can consider how the effect resembles the cause. We can consider how the effect fails to attain a perfect likeness to its cause. These are the 3 ways to consider the relation between a cause and effect when the effect is not equal to the cause. This list is exhaustive. First, we ask, which is the cause, thus having the power to create the effect? Second, we ask, how the effect resembles its cause. Lastly, we ask how the effect falls short of the cause. St. Thomas refers to these three ways of knowing in several places, sometimes naming the three ways differently, but always preserving the division. For example, in the Summa Theologiae, he writes, "We know God from creatures as their principle, and also by way of excellence and remotion." By remotion, he means here just how the effect is removed or distant from the cause. Every created being and every action or operation of every created being, as they are effects of God, may be considered in these three ways. I will refer to these three ways as the way of causation, the way of transcendence, and the way of remotion. First, the way of causation. We see God as the cause. When we considered our car, we inferred that the engineer had the power to make the car, although we, of course, then only meant that he could combine or rearrange what already existed to assemble what we call a car. The engineer's making is only analogous. The pieces combined by the man do not have new internal principles of motion or new natures. God, on the other hand, is the cause of even of the existence of the matter in a substance, and he causes everything to be what it is, so that each thing may have its own internal principle of change. It's something like this: we make puppets, but God makes Pinocchios. Secondly, the way of transcendence. We see how each creature is a likeness of God. We call this way the way of transcendence because if a creature has any perfection, God had it first, but in a transcendent way. Therefore, whenever we see a perfection in a creature, we can say that God also has that perfection, only in an even higher way. Thomas says God is the supereminent principle. Even when we say that God exists, what we really mean is that God has the perfection that creatures have who also exist, although he exists in a transcendent way. For us, existing is sort of like going for a walk. There was a time when I wasn't walking, and there may be a time when I am walking again. Walking is accidental to who I am. Likewise, there was a time when I did not exist. But for God, his existence is his essence. As Thomas says, when we say that God exists, the subject and the predicate are the same. Of course, there is a reason why we say both God exists and I exist. We aren't purely equivocating. We mean something like God really exists while we somehow participate in his existing. Because God knows himself perfectly, creates from nothing, and gives every being its nature, the beings that God creates can be reflections of him much more than our fabrications can be like us. We know even ourselves imperfectly. When we do make things, we cannot instill new essences into them, crafted to reflect ourselves. Imagine you attempted to write a poem, which you hoped would perfectly reflect who you are, although you do not know who you are. Not fully, anyway. What few tired ideas would you bring together to express the understanding you do have? How well do you know the created beings you would be bringing together to attempt this expression? How truly would your poem finally reflect who you are? God, on the other hand, having none of these difficulties, molds his creatures to reflect him just as he pleases. He is not a desperate poet stretching hackneyed phrases past their breaking, always eluded by a subject he barely understands. So it is that there is far more the likeness of God in every unassuming rock than our automotive engineer could ever put into his greatest work. God has given the rock existence. We can come to know more about God from the rock than we can know of the engineer from his car. Every perfection we see in the rock is a perfection that is present, only to a greater extent, already in God. But thirdly, just as we saw that the car falls short of its designer, the perfection in creatures falls far short of the perfection in God. This is the way of remotion. Most obviously, when we observe any imperfection in a creature, we can deny that of God. Indeed, we may separate from God whatever the sense or imagination apprehends. When we assemble machines or write poetry, we assemble things that are like us because they are material, contingent beings. As material beings, we share a genus with our fabrications. But God shares no genus with the things he creates. There is, in this sense, no proportion between God and his creatures. Just as Euclid insists that we can't put together many lines to obtain an area, we can't put together many creatures to get a creator. In this way, cars are much more like car engineers than creatures are like God. Of the three ways, the way of causation seems to be primary in one sense. We can only follow the ways of transcendence or emotion because God is the cause of everything. He makes everything to both resemble and fall short of himself. The way of transcendence has its own virtue. It is most accessible to us. It is the way most conformable to our human way of knowing. Consider our use of metaphor to understand God. The way of transcendence seems implicit in every metaphor, in every such metaphor. When we say that God is a rock, don't we mean something like, there is some excellence in the rock that God has, although in a supereminent way? But the way of emotion gives us the most and the most certain knowledge of God. It is the way most suited for the science of God. When I say that God is a rock, I'm speaking metaphorically. I know, of course, that God isn't actually a rock. But when I say that God is not a rock, I am not speaking metaphorically. I really am certain that he is not a rock. Likewise, when I say that God exists, I am speaking analogically. This is because his existence transcends the existence which I have or know. But when I say that God does not exist in the way that I exist, I am not speaking analogically. Thomas says in the Summa Contra Gentiles, in treating of the divine essence, the principal method to be followed is that of remotion. For the divine essence by its immensity surpasses every form to which our intellect reaches, and thus we cannot apprehend it by knowing what it is. But we have some knowledge of it by knowing what it is not, and we come closer to the knowledge of it insofar as we can remove a greater number of things from it by our intellect. For the more completely we see how a thing differs from others, the more perfectly we know it. Now, God created nothing in vain, and he created nothing for something other than God. It follows that every particular thing we observe he created for himself, but he also created it for us, because in these three ways we can come to know about God through everything he made. Thomas says in his De Veritate, every knower implicitly knows God when he knows anything. It follows from all of this that we should be looking out at creation. We ought to be looking out at as much of creation as we can. As God said to Abraham, raise your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever. We can't look to just any one thing because no one thing can perfectly represent God, who is simple. Thomas says in his compendium, the things produced by God could not be endowed with the likeness of the divine goodness and the simplicity in which that goodness is found in God. Hence, what is one and simple in God had to be represented in created things in various and dissimilar ways. Consequently, there had to be diversity in the things produced by God, in order that the diversity found in things might in its own way imitate the divine perfection. Obviously, we should attempt to understand man. Of all material beings, man seems most obviously like God. Man knows, man wills, man loves. But we should also contemplate the most humble creatures. We do not have a world with only men and no rocks. Rather, we have a world in which the very rocks are in part the causes of mankind. We are dust, and to dust we shall return. Ordinary matter, the most basic of stuff, is in a way the most like God, because in a way it is the most causal. Not many things are not made of something. There are some. No. And although we see actions, colors, places, before we consider numbers or shapes, in the order of being, quantity comes before the later accidents. You can't have a color if you don't first have a size. Basic mathematical ideas, say triangles, which can be considered apart from any sensible matter, are in this way much more like God than people are. You cannot consider a man apart from his matter, but triangles can be considered apart from matter. Triangles, like God, don't change. As a practical suggestion, the essential thing is that when you students study any one thing, you ask yourself what its perfection is. When you discover the good in a triangle, you will love it. But know that you are really discovering and thus growing in love for that same good more present in the triangle's creator. His too is every perfection that you may find in Aristotle, Dante, or Einstein. St. Paul says in his letter to the Philippians, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence And if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. St. Thomas continues, moreover, diversity among things was rightly established according to a definite order, so that some things might be more excellent than others. For this pertains to the lavishness of the divine goodness, that God should communicate a likeness of his goodness to created things as far as possible. Now, God is not only good in himself, but exceeds other beings in goodness, and guides them towards goodness. Consequently, so that the likeness which created beings bear to God might be heightened, it was necessary for some things to be made better than others, and for some to act upon others by leading them toward perfection. Hear that again. God's creation should communicate his likeness as far as possible. But God's goodness excels all others, and he leads lesser beings to greater goodness. How could creation resemble God in these respects? There must be higher and lesser beings, and the higher beings must lead the lesser ones towards God. How will the higher beings guide the lower beings toward God? Some examples are obvious. Adults lead children to holiness. The angels lead us. But how are we humans supposed to lead the rocks to God? How are we supposed to promote the good of the least of creation? Promoting the good of creation is stewardship. The Second Vatican Council's Gaudium et Spes says, man was created in God's image and was commanded to conquer the earth and to rule the world in justice and holiness. He was to acknowledge God as maker of all things and relate himself and the totality of creation to him, so that through the dominion of all things by man, the name of God would be majestic in all the earth. How is man to exercise dominion over all things? How are we to relate all things to God? What does it even mean for us to exercise dominion over a universe that is far greater than we could ever see, let alone cultivate? We exercise this stewardship by knowing creation. We are stewards of all of creation, but our stewardship is first of all intellectual. This is why our stewardship is distinctly human. What is intellectual stewardship? Stewardship here means making creation do what it should do. Making creation do what it should do, which is to reveal God. Creation reveals God precisely when it is known. Consider that if our stewardship were primarily to be understood physically, if we were primarily charged with tilling the universe's fields, God would be asking us to do what we cannot do. We can touch only the tiniest fraction of the created universe, but our immaterial intellects can reach what the longest shovels never will. We lead rocks to God by making them known. A rock cannot know itself. And in this way, it is utterly unlike God, who knows himself perfectly. When God knows himself, he of course sees God in himself. But the rock cannot know itself. It becomes more like God the more it is known, and the more the resemblance of God is known in it. God is eternal and unchanging. He contains no matter. Every rock is a material being, and therefore subject to corruption. The rock is now, but will not be forever. But when a rock is known, it is brought into our immaterial intellects, and so it becomes, in a way, immortal. We bring it to perfection. When we know the rock and bring the rock to perfection, we also bring ourselves to perfection. In this way, we become more like God. For again, God is not only good in himself, but exceeds the other beings in goodness and guides them towards goodness. Consequently, so that the likeness which created beings bear to God might be heightened, it was necessary for some things to be made better than others, and for some to act upon others by leading them toward perfection. This is why knowing is worth it. Even when we know what has already been known, it is worth learning your Euclid, even though many other people already know it. And this is why we must never say, but when will I ever use this mathematics? In Genesis, God commanded us to be stewards over all of creation. But then when he sees that everything is good, he rests. He likewise commands us to rest. Are we to think that our stewardship has ended when this resting begins? I think we should rather say that in this physical rest, which is ordered fundamentally to the knowing of God, Our stewardship has not ended, but is most profoundly realized. It is on the last day that we are in the highest sense stewards of creation. As the scholastic adage has it, what is first in intention is last in execution. God's intention from the beginning was that we be knowers. What is the world for? Although it is not the most final answer, we can see that it is for being known. When we know creation, we cause it to do what it was made to do. We cause it to lead us to God. To be like God, we must know God, who knows himself perfectly. When we know, we become like him, both because he knows perfectly and because through our knowing we imitate him, who leads the least of his creation to him. This is why we come to know God by first knowing the things which are least like him. We know him by way of causation, transcendence, and remotion. Because we can know these lesser things, we become like God, who is greater than everything and leads everything to himself. Are you not in awe of God's magnificence? He has so carefully shaped you that even the way you must come to know makes you an imitation of his perfection. But we must also see in this a responsibility. We are stewards. We have a job to do. If we do not know the rocks, who will know them? Will we abandon the rocks to remain unknown? If the master on his departure has left these talents for us and charged us as his stewards, will we lead them to increase, or perhaps we should bury them back into the ground? I do not think God's work will be so easily foiled. God's creation will make him known. As he was now approaching the path down from the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the deeds of power that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven." Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, order your disciples to stop." He answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the stones themselves would cry out. For now our knowing will be imperfect. We must reason from God's effects, which are not equal to their cause. But through this, we and creation may be brought to perfection. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have fully been known." Thank you.
Dr. Olson's lecture, it seems to me, is appropriate for the season of Advent. As Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI said, quote, "Advent invites us to pause in silence to understand a presence. It is an invitation to understand that the individual events of the day are hints that God is giving us, signs of the attention he has for each one of us," close quote. That is, we can know God by knowing the events and the world around us. "The heavens declare the glory of God," sang the psalmist. And during the holiday season, as it's called, few people are so cynical and hardened that they utterly refuse to see it. As Christ's ambassadors, you and I can lend a hand by lovingly pointing out that glory and the God who in creation and in his incarnate Son makes himself known for the salvation of the world. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.